Okay, we have a blue light. We'll call this meeting of the Veterans and Emergency Services Committee together, and we have informational meetings today and a couple of public hearings on some fairly short bills, I think. We're all pleased with the unanimous passage of both of the memorials this morning, so that's a good thing. We'll begin today with a informational update on the 211 system.
You'll have to apologize. I have to wear my reading glasses or I won't be able to read to you.
I don't believe you have to apologize to me. And if you folks could identify yourselves for the records, we'd appreciate it.
We'll do that.
Thank you.
Chair Cohen and members of the House Committee on Veterans Emergency Services, thank you for giving us this opportunity to update you on 211 in Oregon. My name is Stephen Guntley, and I am the current Executive Director of Oregon 211. I had been on the Board of Directors for this nonprofit agency for several years and was Board Chair for a year and a half before I took over as Executive Director last September. Our goal is to establish 211 service in every county in Oregon. Oregon 211 is working closely with 211 Info to accomplish that goal, and I want to introduce my colleague, Jerry Shumate, who will tell you more about that nonprofit organization.
Thank you, Chair Cohen and members of the committee. My name is Jerry Shumate. I've been the executive director of 211 Info since it started in May of 2004. Stephen and I have provided copies of our PowerPoint slide presentation. For your information, we've also given you a one-page summary of 211 in Oregon and two pages of testimony that we'll be referring to as we go through our presentation. We know we have a limited amount of time, so we'll move through as quickly as possible with the hope that we'll have a few minutes for questions at the end. 211 is critically important to our health and human services community, especially during our current economic crisis when information on housing, job training, food, and shelter have become critical. Our callers' needs include family and children's services, financial assistance, help with utility needs, health care, mental health, and government programs. With proper funding, we also have the ability to provide special support and help for our veteran population. We will touch on this in a moment. 211 is also critically important to the public safety community, having been embraced nationally by police, fire, and 911 personnel as a vital new tool that supports their efforts both during normal times and especially during a disaster or a crisis. So what is 211 exactly? 211 is to social services what 911 is to emergency services. It's a single, easy-to-remember telephone number that helps people find and give help. With almost 14,000 nonprofit organizations in Oregon, plus scores of government agencies, many with 800 numbers to be remembered, finding help can be confusing and intimidating. Many people give up before they even find the help they need. 211 offers a trained specialist who quickly assesses the caller's needs and refers them to the help that they need. 211 Info currently serves the Tri-County area of Portland and Southwest Washington and has helped Central Oregon, particularly Crooks, Deschutes, and Jefferson County, launch 211 service this past month. 211 has benefits both over both existing information and referral hotlines and specialized 800 numbers. It creates a centralized response system and centralized database of information. It uses a real person to help callers find the help they need, and states that have implemented 211 statewide have experienced cost savings and efficiencies over their previous systems of information and referral support.
211 has been in existence since 1997 and was officially designated for use as a specialized service in the year 2000. As Jerry told you, it was launched in Oregon in the Portland area in 2004, and Central Oregon initiated service just last month. In 2005, Governor Kulongowski signed legislation encouraging the establishing establishment of 211 in Oregon, set up an account in the state treasury to receive funds, and designated oversight of these funds to the Office of Emergency Management. Oregon 211 has worked closely with staff at both the Department of Human Services and the Office of Emergency Management, and especially with Ken Murphy at OEM, to build the public-private partnership that would allow us to create statewide 211 service. We are also encouraged by the fact that the United Way of America has made the funding of 211 at the federal level their number one funding priority. Now, I'm sure the committee will be interested in this next slide.
Or maybe a previous slide.
I think it's the slide on the disasters. Yeah. Well, there we go. 211 has been proven effective in other states during disasters such as terrorist attacks, hurricanes, fires, and floods. When 211 is available and updated regularly, it is cheaper and responds more rapidly than having a program in reserve waiting to turn on when disaster strikes. After 9/11, over 300 hotlines and helplines were created in New York. Next door in Connecticut, they used 211. Years later, those hotlines have disappeared, but Connecticut 211 continues to take calls from people who are still recovering from that day. After Hurricane Katrina and Rita, the 211 systems in Louisiana and Texas handled hundreds of thousands of calls with support from trained 211 staff from around the country. In November of 2007, San Diego 211 and six other 211s in Southern California together responded to 130,000 calls in just 5 days. 211 handled calls about shelter and evacuation routes, leaving 911 available to respond to people in life-threatening situations. And there is a quote from Bill Gore, the undersheriff of San Diego County, which I'll let you read. But 211 was invaluable during these and other disasters and crises in other states. Jerry?
If 211 had been fully functional in Oregon the past year, the system would have been critical in response to the recent snowstorms and flooding, and certainly the flooding in Vernonia a year ago. Washington State's 211 was activated as part of the state's emergency plan during the storms and their aftermath, and WIN 211 had an official presence at the State Emergency Operations Center.
Now, 211 has been growing nationally and now has a major presence across the country. In fact, about 78% of the U.S. population has at least partial access to 211. Oregon currently serves about 48% of our population, but only in six counties. The reality is that because of lack of funding, many citizens, even in those six counties, do not know that 211 exists. And current 211 service does not have emergency funds to ramp up their service during disasters or crises. At the federal level, the Calling for 211 Act has been introduced to fund 211 across the country, and we are working with our colleagues to encourage support of this legislation and also pursuing other types of federal support through grants or federal earmarks. Now, this slide is a picture that shows the prevalence of 211 in our country. All the green states have 100% coverage. That is 26 states and Puerto Rico. But more important for us, it also includes Washington, Idaho, and Utah. California and Nevada are 80% covered, as are a total of seven more states. Oregon sits there in orange with about 48% coverage. As I said previously, that is six of our counties. But even there, we lack the funding to truly market this wonderful service and respond to additional calls during a disaster. 211 in Portland and now in Central Oregon survives with major support from the United Way and a constantly shifting flow of funds from local government sources and private funds.
Now the good news. With the cooperative efforts of Oregon 211 and 211 Info, we are continuing to build both interest and infrastructure in 211 across the state, in spite of the financial challenges that are present in our economy these days. Before you is a map that shows all the counties of Oregon. The green stars reflect counties that have 211 service. You can now dial 211 if you're in those counties anytime Monday to Friday between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. the counties that are marked in red, specifically Yamhill, Lane, and Douglas, are what I would call very high prospects for being able to provide 211 to their residents within the next year, possibly sooner. Yamhill County, I believe, is looking at this summer. The remaining counties that are have yellow stars on them have, within the last 6 months, called me, called someone in the 211 system and expressed an interest in bringing 211 to that community. So there's a tremendous amount of interest that's just surged really in the past 6 months. The remaining counties, we have talked with some folks in some of them. I learned yesterday that there actually is quite an interest in Coos and Curry counties, so you should consider yellow stars there as well. And I think it's really a matter of the capacity to get the word to those counties that this service may be appropriate for them as well. 211 is core infrastructure for public, or 911 is core infrastructure for public safety, and 211 is core infrastructure for human services. 211 is essential in normal times, but essentially, it's especially important in our current economic crisis. Having 211 available in an emergency or crisis in our state would be an essential tool for 911 and the Office of Emergency Management.
We want to tell this committee that we will continue to seek funds for current 211 service and are continuing to seek a true public-private partnership to roll out 211 statewide. As you can see from this report, we are making progress. Finally, I wanted to let you know that through the efforts of Oregon 211 and 211 Info, 211 could be deployed anywhere in Oregon within hours. We have that technical ability to turn 211 on in any county in the state. Since 211 has been declared an approved FEMA partner, reimbursement is available to pay for the service if deployed during a declared emergency or crisis. We are seeking funding from any and all sources to create a statewide plan so we would be able to actually utilize 211 anywhere in the state, at least during an emergency or crisis. That would be a major step forward for our state and for the Office of Emergency Management. And if we have time today, we welcome your questions or comments or concerns. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Are there any questions with these folks? Well, I think that you can take that as a thorough presentation, that we all understand what 211 is. We're also all painfully aware of our challenging budgetary times, and probably unlikely that new funding is on the horizon in this particular biennium.
But. And we do understand that, but we will continue to seek private funding as well as federal funding with the hopes that at some point here in the future, we can all come together and fund this important service.
I think we're all hoping for a brighter future for us.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Cohen.
Okay. Thank you very much for your time today. And Mr. Murphy, this committee has a number of folks that are new to this particular subject, so the whole conversation about seismic upgrades have been going on for some time, but it seemed like it might be a good time to have our resident experts, Mr. Murphy and General Caldwell, here to kind of bring us up to speed. Thank you for coming.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. And Ken has put together some interesting graphics that are going to be passed out, and I'll let him explain the nuances of this great science. Like I told him this morning, I always learn something when we talk about subduction zones and plates and shifts and tsunamis and that sort of thing. So
it usually gives me nightmares, so I'd like you to be kind here today.
Well, that's why whenever I go to your fair city, I rent a place on the hill now. I no longer rent on the beach after Ken's last presentation.
Please don't share that with my tourism.
I won't.
Okay?
But
we do have a map here that will go on a screen, but for the record, my name is Ken Murphy. I'm the Director of Oregon Emergency Management, which is a division of the Oregon Military Department. And Full disclosure, I'm not a scientist or a geologist, so if you have any technical questions, I wished Dr. McConnell was here from the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries to answer any of those really technical questions, but I will always give you the layman's explanation.
Well, I believe she's going to be with us in a week or so we could jot down the really important stuff.
She can give
stuff.
You the really scary facts. So the two pictures that you have in front of you for comparison purposes, one is of the Cascadia subduction zone off of the North American continent involving Canada, Washington, Oregon, and primarily Northern California. And the map on the left there is the trench in the Indian Ocean near Sumatra, which I think most people are well aware of the devastating earthquake and subsequent tsunami that happened in 2005. And just as some comparisons as you look at this, and again, I will not even pretend to try and explain it, but as you all know, the earth is moving constantly and there's plates that are in the earth's below the surface that are constantly moving against each other in different forms and methods. And bottom line is that the Cascadia subduction zone, which really, as you look at this, is this here. This is the North American plate that sets off our coast, and a little bit farther off our northern coast, very close when you get down into the Brookings and Gold Beach area on the very south coast. And this area here is about 800 miles long from Brooks Peninsula off of Vancouver Island in Canada down to Cape Mendocino in Northern California. And not too different lengthwise with this trench here, this subduction zone. And we have quite a few different ridges and plates that affect this. And you can see the two primary ones here, the Juan de Fuga Ridge and the Gorda Plate. And those are the two primary ones. The others can have effect, but they're constantly pushing against each other. And depending on how the scientist would couch it, the last time that these plates caused a major earthquake was the year 1700. And there's plenty of history on the Oregon coast to show the events that took place when you do soil samples and dig down into the sand and some of the dead forests that are on the Oregon coast. Now, the scientist will tell you that these things can happen anywhere from 300 to 500 year spans. You know, it's kind of like a little bit of playing a lottery, you know, where you fit on that time scale. But I think Dr. McConnell and her folks from the Department of Geology and Mineral Industry would tell you that there's a certain chance, somewhere between 15% and 30%, that these type of things could happen within the next 50 years or so, but, unknown. The science is still developing. It wasn't that many years ago that we did not actually know about some of these things off of the west coast of the North American continent. But these plates are constantly pushing, and what will happen, very simply, that these plates will slam into each other and cause the resulting earthquake. And in earthquakes, a lot has to deal with the depth of the earthquake, how far down in the earth's crust it happens, or how close to the surface. And then if the plates react in such a way, and this is what happened in Sumatra and the Indian Ocean, the plates hit each other and they cause the earth to shove up. And so in the Indian Ocean, it created about a 750-mile-long chunk of earth to uplift by about 40 feet, which caused the tsunami. It pressed the water up, and the tsunami started moving. And those tsunamis, depending on the pressure and the size of the earthquake, can reach over 500 miles an hour when they move. So they're very unforgiving. As you all know, water is a very powerful force when it's moving in great quantities. And so when it hits the coastline with the resulting earthquake, it's extremely damaging. And it also depends on what the actual coastline looks like underneath the water. It may slow the tsunami down or it may speed it up, depending on the angles of the seafloor. And then, of course, any river openings on the Oregon coast, that's just an opening for the tsunami to continue to move 500 miles an hour up that river until debris or earth itself stops it. So that's really what's setting off our coastline. Really, if something were to happen, people on the Oregon coast have very little time to react. We have different methods across our communities of sirens, reader boards, signage, many different methods there to alert people. And one thing that we've always tried to promote, with all these things we do, to some extent, the best way to, if the ground is shaking, it's time to move to high ground. And we also recommend that you do that by walking, not driving, because a lot of the coastal roads become clogged very easily with one or two cars moving. And so clearly move to high ground and do it on foot. And many parts of our coast, depending on the height of the wave, are not necessarily affected. The Department of Geology and Mineral Industries and with some of our assistance, we have mapped, the Department of Geology and Minerals have mapped many of the inundation zones for our Oregon coastal communities. So that's just a quick review of really what we face. In my humble opinion, this would be our Hurricane Katrina to happen here. If it affected, I know in our exercises that we do at my office, we just basically say everything west of I-5 up and down from Canada to Northern California is in rubble. And so you know, where do you start and how do you fix those things and deal with the issues of literally millions of people affected, all transportation routes and that type of thing. So just some background on the seismic rehabilitation program. First of all, I'll tell you here in our notes, this is all the great effort of Senator Courtney and his deep concerns and desires to make sure that the citizens of Oregon are protected. And as you can see here, and I won't read these notes verbatim, but in 2001 in the 71st legislature, he introduced into law the Educational Building and Seismic Safety and Acute Inpatient Care Facility, Fire Station, and Police Station Seismic Safety. So we're really looking at schools, fire stations, police stations, and hospitals, and to try and protect those facilities and the people in them. During that same legislative session, we had two ballot measures, 15 and 16, that were passed through Senator Courtney's efforts to amend the Constitution to allow the state to lend credit through general obligation bonds for seismic rehabilitation of those aforementioned facilities that I've talked about. And the people of the state of Oregon voted in favor of that on November 5th, 2002, and adopted those, and we started then to build the system from that point on. As you can go through here, and I, again, will not read this, additionally, part of the legislation that came out of this was some time frames. As noted in the notes, the emergency service buildings, fire stations, police stations, those type of things happen until 2022, and then the schools for 2032 to try and rehabilitate seismically all of those facilities that need it. Also in that, the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries was tasked with doing a compilation of data to evaluate all those buildings. As you can well imagine, and I'm sure you all know from your respective districts and the state of Oregon, we have many schools, many police stations, many fire stations, and so this was a great task and a daunting task, but I think it's one that bared some very good information, you know, to help us make some decisions as we go through this process. And then the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries then requested the money to do their work and also worked with the Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Council, and they convened a task force and how they were going to implement the things that had come out of the 71st legislative session. And from that, in the 2005-2007 legislative session, there was a series of Senate bills introduced. and I'll just highlight them. They're listed on your handout. Senate Bill 2, again, tasks the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries in consultation with various stakeholder groups to develop this statewide needs assessment, and they use their expertise and some information from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and they developed a product called a rapid visual screening product of the buildings and information about their structures, whether they're unreinforced masonry, and also where they set in Oregon in relation to the different types of geological hazards that we face across the state. And then Senate Bill 3 was developed, which directed the Office of Emergency Management to develop a grant program for seismic rehabilitations of these buildings, and a grant committee, and it specified the membership of that committee, and asked us to begin the development of that in relationship to also using the information from the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries as one of the tools that we'd use in our ability to give out those grants. And then Senate Bill 4 dealt with allows the state treasurer and the director of the Department of Administrative Services to, subject to the specified limits of those bonds, and to carry out the procedures needed for those. And then Senate Bill 5, again, very much similar. It was broken into the two types of bonds. One set of bonds was for schools only. The other one was for the emergency service facilities. And then finally, Senate Bill 1 appropriated money for my office to actually have the people to begin the process of developing the program. And we've started developing it with our stakeholders, and we've come to the point now where the program, the grant application, the actual grant package is developed. We have a report to do here in about 10 days to Ways and Means on where we're at in the process. And with the help of Senator Courtney and his staff, keeping on track, trying to make this system workable and usable for our local jurisdictions when they apply. We've had members of the fire service, the police service, hospitals, community colleges, K through 12 as part of our stakeholder group. And we have two products that we're still working on. One is a benefit cost analysis. It's an electronic tool that will help jurisdictions fill out the grant application and provide them a mathematical equation that will be filled in with geological information from USGS and also the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries to help determine the ratio of what they will save or what the process will be, and that's used as a discriminator to help us determine which projects are more eligible. And then the other one is an online electronic e-tool for the actual grant application to do that. And the governor in the governor's recommended budget does have $30 million in it for this program. And hopefully that will make it through the system, this particular legislative cycle, so that we can process this. And at this point in time, hopefully we've had good interest from each one of the respective groups, fire, police, hospitals, and schools, and community colleges, and interested in doing this, and hopefully we'll be able to use the money carefully, discreetly, so that everybody gets a chance as much as we can, if we do get the $30 million, you know, to get as much done in the seismic rehabilitation of facilities. And also, I think, too, we're looking at, for schools, the type of rehabilitation would be the life safety type of thing, so that the children and young adults in our school system can get out of the building safely. For fire, police, and hospitals, we're looking at the type of seismic retrofit that will keep those buildings standing, because we need those type of facilities standing after a disaster, so that our public safety and our health services can continue. So that is generally where we're at on this process. We've had a lot of good input from all the stakeholder groups, and so we'll make our report. We have some guidance that we'll be asking from Ways and Means on some policy matters, but I think we're short of getting these two electronic tools done. We'll be ready to implement the program as soon as the money is available. And that's all I have. If I'll entertain any questions on this.
Thank you. I think that's a helpful background to sort of pull together the history and where we are right now, and as we, some may be on Ways and Means and others are just sort of hearing about the process, so it's good to put it in context. Just for clarification, that $30 million, is that in bonding authority then?
Yes, it is, Madam
Out
Chair.
Out of those two particular types of bonds.
Yes.
Questions? Representative Compton. Oh,
well, and Chair, the question is more for you and our leadership here in the committee. Are we going to have access to the report that's going to be shared with Ways and Means, and not necessarily during committee time, but get an electronic copy of that?
Or? We will provide it.
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Because sometimes I can't sleep at night.
Particularly when you're vacationing.
You take your computer to bed with you just in case.
Just in case. I need
it online.
Yes.
Yes, there should be absolutely no problem once we get that. And I would ask to indulge the Chair and Representative Comp, once we've got through our report to Ways and Means, any changes or guidance, then we can add that to it, and so you can see the complete picture.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Just sort of wanted to have everybody up to speed when that information started coming out. So, any other questions on this issue? Rep. Boone.
Just a comment, and I just wanted to... tell the committee I toured Friday at Tualatin Valley Water District and heard about some of the seismic upgrades that they're talking about implementing. And I know they work with OEM, and I'm sure they'd love to work with you, General Caldwell. But some of the things that they're doing, I think, could be applied to smaller water districts around our state as far as getting ready for emergency situations and some of the... for example, their potable water system that they have. And Portland has the same capability that if something bad happens, when something bad happens, they'll be able to stock people, with sterile liter bags of water, up to 6 per person. I'm sure you guys will be involved in that, too. So anyway, just some more information that's very valuable to us as we become more educated on this.
Thank you. Representative Boone had shared how interesting that tour was and mentioned that these folks might be interested in reporting back to this committee. We'll sort of see how scheduling goes to see if we could manage that.
Yeah.
I'm sure it would be interesting. Representative Compton.
Just a comment. Thank you, Chair Cowan. As a former principal, and the middle school where I worked at butted up next to a large group of what we call senior states in Woodburn, mm-hmm. and I had lots of phone calls a couple of years ago about, is our school up to seismic grade so that people could come to our school to feel safe? And I didn't like to be the bearer of bad news, but definitely the school is not up to seismic code. But these types of things are so critical to our emotional well-being and our understanding that people are preparing for it, and I really appreciate the work.
Other questions, comments? Okay, well, thank you for that, and I think probably you don't need to leave your chairs
stay
here.
Stay right here.
We will close the informational hearing and open a public hearing. First of all, House Bill 2167. Gentlemen, perhaps maybe Mr. Molina would lead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2167 modifies timing of payment of certain administrative expenses of Office of Emergency Management from monies in Emergency Communications Account.
I take this as being sort of a housekeeping bill, but you are going to explain to us what that means, I'm hoping.
It is housekeeping, yes. Yeah.
Yes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ken Murphy, Director of Oregon Emergency Management, and House Bill 2167. This particular one deals with the administrative costs that cost my agency through our 911 group to be able, currently, the way the system is set up, they're able to spend money but based on the way the money is collected and distributed throughout the quarters, many times the way the original language was written, we were not able to use money that was currently, there was no money currently available in the accounts, or it had already been distributed out, so we were deficit spending, taking money from other accounts. And so this changes the language that allows us then to use the money that's in the account for our administrative needs, which is capped at 4%, and allows us then to have that money, not spend money from other accounts into the 911 system, and then, of course, as we normally do, reconcile at the end of each quarter and go through that. So it was really the language change just simply to allow us to move the quarters and where we could actually spend the money and not deficit spend against some other account because the cash or the actual money wasn't there. So we're not creating any new money or any new accounts. It was just moving the ability for us to help pay for our administrative cost and not take it from other types of accounts.
Thank you. General Caldwell, do you have anything to add to that?
Madam Chair, the only comment I would make is that there have been situations where actually there was money in the account, but he couldn't get at it. And that's really what this is going to... makes no logical sense. So we go through gyrations in the accounting department to borrow money from other accounts to make payments that should be coming out of this account. So this just frees it up in the simplest terms.
And I believe this bill also has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, so you'll get to explain that to the Ways and Means Committee.
We can hardly wait.
Absolutely.
Are there any preliminary questions just to warm them up for this class? Okay, then. If there are no questions, I will close the public hearing and we'll bring this back fairly quickly so that we can get it moved on to the its next stage of development. And I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2168. Hi there.
Hi, Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. I keep forgetting these introductions. I apologize.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2168 removes outdated, unnecessary, or incorrect language, conforms language to form and style requirements.
Madam Chair, members.
And maybe we could move on beyond all these numbers and explain what we're talking about here, too.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this truly, we had a Secretary of State's audit and also a audit and review by the Department of Administrative Services on these accounts when we were moving out of the Oregon State Police structure into the Oregon Military Department. And one of the recommendations, and as many of you know, the 911 language has been in the ORSs for probably 20-plus years. And you know, some of the language was not correct or not in conformity manner with what legislative counsel said that was correct form and style. So there's 15 pages to this particular House bill. If you will trust me, I can tell you that we really have not changed anything in the law dealing with how 911 is managed or how it affects the public safety answering points across our state. It just simply tried to correct the language, make it easier to read. There were some corrections that actually things that were historical in nature. I will just relate you to page 3 under section 4. It talked about 7-digit telephone numbers. Well, we have 10-digit telephone numbers in this new world that we live in. So those type of fixes to bring into context proper language and hopefully make it read better to, you know, those that need the law and read this. So I can go through this page by page, Madam Chair, if you want, and try and explain it, but it was really trying to make it an easier read and more correct in form and style.
Do I have any request for them to review this page by page? Guessing not.
From the look on everyone's face.
I'm just taking a little direction from my committee here for those at home listening or watching this. And are there any particular questions that popped up as you, I'm sure, completely reviewed this bill prior to committee?
Word for word.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Did you have anything else?
Oh.
Okay. Well, we do have Verna Porter here. Would you like to speak to this bill? Or maybe she's not here anymore.
No, she's not here.
Okay. Perhaps that was. Is there anyone else who would like to address the issues here in this bill at all? Okay. Seeing none, then I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2168. And again, we'll bring this back fairly quickly. It was not set for work session today. Is there anything else for the good of this committee? It looks like I've actually let you off easy today. I'll try not to make that mistake in scheduling again.
You could do the work session real fast and just pass them on.
It's not advertised for a work session. I can't do that.
Can't do it.
Okay, with that, we're adjourned.
Okay.